Our next case is 13-414, State of Ohio versus Joseph Harris. For the appellant, Ms. Lapp.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes in rebuttal. In this case, the state is asking you to interpret legislative intent of revised code 2945.371. Before I proceed, there's one thing a point I'd like to make, because this does impact all of my argument. In the appellee's filings, there's a list given of all the things asserted that Dr. Dreyer, the psychologist, testified to. And there's a list of many, many points. There's only one thing she testified to in the state's case in chief, which was, do you have an opinion on whether Joseph Harris was malingering? And she stated, yes, I do. He was faking his answers, exaggerating others. The list that's given in the brief, it goes over things like, did he have an antisocial personality? What did he think of the rights of others, etc.? All of that was brought out on cross-examination by defense counsel, not by the state. And I think that's just very important.
Counsel, doesn't that impede or take away the jury's determination of credibility? Isn't it for the jury to determine whether someone is telling the truth or not? And here we have a situation where the defendant then did testify, and this was in the state's case in chief, where you have the doctor on the stand, the expert witness, talking about, a credibility issue of the defendant, saying this person is faking it. So isn't that seems to me to be the real problem here.
Well, the reason I don't think that is a problem is because the state is always permitted to bring in evidence of consciousness of guilt. And you can say that consciousness of guilt has some effect on how you view credibility, but consciousness of guilt is permitted. This statute, when you look at it, it has to do with protecting the interests of people who are legitimately being examined for an NGRI or an incompetency. It's how to give an accurate assessment, an accurate diagnosis. And it was, if you look at the legislative intent, there's nothing in the statute or the history that would ever show that it was ever meant to protect a defendant and give a defendant a green light to go abuse the whole examination procedure and to use it as in essence a fraud on the court and to manipulate the system. The whole theme in this case was Harris's manipulation of witnesses, of the examiner, of the jury, of the victim. Even at trial, he's blowing kisses at the victim's family. During closing argument, he jumps up and started yelling accusations at the prosecutor, calling him names and saying he wants to get him out of there. Malingering, I believe, when you look at all the cases, is a permissible comment on consciousness of guilt during the case in chief. There's no explanation in the record of why the prosecutor didn't wait until rebuttal, but if you look at the comments during the arguments as to why he was going forward with this, he said consciousness of guilt. We are permitted to bring in evidence that someone has lied about their identity, that they have concealed things, that they've tried to escape, and this is along the same line.
But counsel, even if we agree with you that it would be allowed under the statute, wouldn't there still be a problem under the evidence rules? Was that argued below, where you had maybe an argument under 403 or 404 that this is highly prejudicial given the source of the information? So even if it would be permissible or relevant, I guess is the better word, wouldn't it still be highly prejudicial coming from this witness? And isn't that an independent problem?
I don't see that as a problem at all. This was his conduct after the crime and after arrest. The actual statements about, say, the commission of the crime, no statements were admitted. There were no statements that he said, I did this, I said this. when you look at all the cases where this court has interpreted statute and the use of that evidence, it always comes down to whether the psychologist testified about actual statements that have to do with, they implicate the defendant in the commission of the crime. Saying he went in and faked answers is not implicating him in the commission of the crime.
Would your answer be different if the NGRI had been withdrawn formally at the time of her testimony? Do you think that she was an allowable witness because that was still on the table? Does that matter to you?
Yes. Can I get a glass of water?
Sure.
When the defendant puts his mental state in question, that's when the state is permitted to bring in evidence, you know, on rebuttal of the actual mental condition. Evidence of feigning and malingering, I think, should be allowed in the case in chief, even if they have not put it in, even if it's been withdrawn, because it still has to do with the conduct of the defendant comments on consciousness of guilt. And I think that would be allowed even if the state, even if the defendant had not withdrawn the NGRI.
Counsel, isn't it at least fair to suggest, however, that when a psychologist comes in and testifies that somebody is malingering, both cognitive and psychiatric difficulties, that psychologist is calling the person a liar?
I have two thoughts when you say this. One, a distinction between issues of factual guilt and issues of psychological mental state.
That's not where I'm going. I'm talking about credibility. Didn't the psychologist come in and label him a liar?
The psychologist never once used that word. The prosecutor never once used that word in any of the arguments. That never was stated.
But you understand what I'm saying. If somebody's malingering, they're not telling the truth.
That's true.
So therefore, they're not worthy of belief.
I think that's true. And I think in this case, it was a pattern of manipulation by this defendant, and that the state was free to bring in that evidence to comment on that.
But the defendant's credibility is at issue when they're on trial.
Yes.
And the defendant is proffering a story or a course of conduct or however, you know, they're trying to defend themselves. And here, the initial foray was into competency issues as a strategy for defense.
That's what initiated it, yes.
And so Harris put it on the table, not the prosecutor, not the state, of competency here.
And NGRI.
And NGRI, and that triggers this assessment to be done by the psychologist, correct?
Correct.
And so that is all post-commission of the crime, and it is something that is, characterized as a cover-up by the defendant to, manipulate facts here?
Yes.
And it is I'm not saying it was his defense counsel strategy, but it was the defense strategy of the defendant.
Initiated
to act out
by
this
the
way and to come up with this. And then the label of malingerer was attached, which is, isn't that why they hire the psychiatrist or the psychologist to begin with, to find out if it's real?
Yes, all of this was initiated by the defense.
Okay. But isn't the fatal problem here the fact that this comes in the case in chief? This is before the defendant even testifies. You're raising the issue of credibility, subtly or not, before the defendant makes the choice to testify. And that's why you have stated in the past, it's been done on rebuttal after the defendant makes a choice. I'm going to take the stand, testify before the jury. Then the state can bring in. I would have no problem with it if it were on rebuttal. But my concern is, in a sense, you're kind of forcing the defendant into taking the stand, and you're making comments upon statements made in the case in chief. That's the concern.
But everything the state puts on has some, reflects in some way on the credibility of the defendant. The inmates that we put on that said, he said, I'm going to fake being crazy. I'm going to try to get people to testify. I'm going to ask you to lie for me and pin it on my co-defendant. Everything, our witnesses, our eyewitnesses, everything we've put on is to, by its nature, to reflect on the defendant's credibility. It's the intent of the statute.
Was Dr. Dreyer's testimony that he was competent or sane? What was her conclusion?
The conclusion was both of those, but the testimony...
Both of those.
Yes, but the testimony wasn't about that.
Ask you this. When, in point of time in the trial, was the defense of not guilty by reason of insanity withdrawn?
It was never clearly withdrawn.
What do you mean, never clearly withdrawn?
It was...
Was it withdrawn, or was it not withdrawn?
I believe it was not withdrawn. It was not withdrawn prior to trial.
So at the time that this expert testified,
yes,
the defense interposed was not guilty by reason of insanity.
Now that plea was there before trial.
Yes,
and it was
had
still
not been
there.
Withdrawn.
Had not been withdrawn.
Okay.
Did they have on their witness list a psychiatrist or psychologist that was going to attest to his mental state?
They did not, but that's a quite common scenario. It often does happen in cases that only when the state's case ends does the state find out whether or not a psychologist or psychiatrist is going to be put on. When the state wanted to put Dr. Dreyer on, and the defense at that time objected, the prosecutor gave his argument, and he was saying this relates to consciousness of guilt. The defense attorney then said, well, if I have to, I could withdraw it now. But did not.
Withdraw the not
NGRI.
Guilty. Okay.
Did not do it, did not put an entry. Only at the end of trial did that defense attorney put on an entry.
At the end of trial?
The end of trial.
And never argued it to the jury?
No.
Okay.
And there's no argument for or against it in opening statements by defense counsel. It's a very general opening statement saying, keep an open mind when you listen to all of the witnesses, you're going to have to, you know, judge the credibility of.
When did you? When did the state put on the inmate information about this guy, Mr. Harris, talking about how he's going to manipulate and how he wants this person to to perjure, et cetera, et cetera? When was that introduced?
Later in the case.
What's later?
There were.
After he testified or before he testified?
Before.
Before, so in the prosecution's case in chief,
yes, case in chief,
they put on other witnesses that say, "Here's what Harris asked me to do. Here's what Harris told me." Okay,
yes.
And I'm presuming Mr. Harris then took the stand in his own defense.
Yes,
and it contradicted that information.
Only part, much of what he said, confirmed a lot of the state's evidence, but in that one part, yes.
What one part?
You're talking about the inmate's testimony?
Right.
He said to some of the statements, yes, I probably said that. Yes, I may have said that. Other times he said, no, they were lying. I mean, there were many, many aspects of...
Okay, my point is that the whole array of prosecution witnesses are there to affect the credibility of the defendant.
Yes.
And to provide evidence that this defendant is guilty of the charge on which he has been indicted.
Yes.
And this witness, the psychologist, the doctor you have, is just one more witness in that line that would provide a perspective on this defendant's credibility.
And that testimony was very limited. That's one of my points.
Only
is,
to the malingering, only
yes.
To the issue of whether he was trying to fake an illness.
Yes. And all the cases where the statute was discussed, it goes into actual statements, like in State v. Goff, the psychologist got up and said, talked about specific pieces of evidence that had been known and commented on it. In Cooey, the psychologist got up and said, oh, yes, the defendant said, yes, I hit my victim.
So the content of their the testing and the interview was never, it was only the conclusion that he's a malingerer was introduced, not the content of their.
Absolutely. There were no facts.
Just the malingering conclusion from a medical or psychological point of view.
Yes.
Ms. Lamp, may I get a clarification from you? At the time the state presented its case in chief, the defense was not guilty by reason of insanity.
It was out hanging out there.
Well, it had been interposed by the defendant, am I correct?
Before trial started, and
yes.
Had never been withdrawn.
All right. And then did the court instruct the jury on not guilty by reason of insanity?
No. The court did instruct the jury that any the evidence that the jury was the body to give weight to the expert testimony and the lay witnesses, and said it's for you to decide the importance of them.
I thought you said in answer to the chief's question that the defense had been withdrawn at the end of trial, and that's what I'm trying to say.
Yes,
was that before the jury instruction or subsequent to the jury instruction?
Right before jury instructions.
So the jury was not instructed on not guilty by reason of insanity?
Correct.
And the defense withdrew it after all of the testimony had been submitted?
Yes. The last day of trial before the jury. The entry was not put on until before jury instructions.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I guess the answer to your questions left me a little bit confused then. Why was Dr. Dreyer testifying?
Because a lot of the state's case, one of the whole themes was the manipulation by this defendant, and it affected credibility to show his consciousness of guilt. All the things he did after he was arrested, the state is permitted to show those and to bring those in. And this was one piece, a very narrow, limited piece, brought in to show that one of the first things he did.
So the doctor was not testifying as to his competence to stand trial?
No. That was determined, competency was determined before trial that he was competent. This is why I think it's so important that you look at the legislative intent here on this. If the legislature was sitting here, would they be saying, oh, yes, we not only wanted to protect people who legitimately are being examined because they might have an NGRI plea, but we're going to protect those people who come in and completely use this as a ruse. We're going to protect people who are going to use this to manipulate the system. And I don't think the legislature intended that. I don't think that applies to the situation when a defendant comes in like this and just blatantly tries to trick.
I don't think that's the concern here. The concern is the timing and whether it was prejudicial to have someone with the credentials of the psychologist come in right off the bat before the defendant gets a chance to talk,
yes.
Or give his testimony. And so it's right off the bat and says, the guy's a malingerer. Which is a cloud of dishonesty over him. And is that prejudicial, even though a cellmate, could come in and say pretty much the same thing as he told me this, that, and the other thing, and that attacks his credibility or it undermines, let's say, his credibility. So is it by virtue of who this witness is? And is that the prejudice that is afforded Mr. Harris?
Yes, there were three different inmates who said this, and these three inmates weren't even known to each other. This leads to the harmless error argument that I think the First District abused its discretion, because in determining how important Dr. Dreyer's testimony was, the First District did not seem to even consider or mention other evidence. They said that before the defendant testified, this would have been harmless error. But after the defendant testified, because he got up and said, well, I wasn't going to rob him, that changed the whole analysis of harmless error. And they didn't even look at the fact that we had an eyewitness, Christina Willis, knew Harris, saw him 10 minutes before the murder, robbing someone else right by the parking lot where this happened. the person who was, Sharon Peoples, was sitting in the parking lot and saw the two co-defendants go to the car, saw Harris get in, heard the gunshots running. He knew Harris previously, knew him from drug dealing in the neighborhood. None of that was considered. And all of that still reflects on, even more, you know, that has to be added into when you're looking at whether it's harmless error or not. And we had, as I said, three different inmates who didn't even know each other.
But counsel, the inmates are different from the doctor, and it's the question of vouching. For example, you wouldn't allow the doctor to get up and say, this is a person you should believe, in my opinion. We don't allow that. We don't allow attorneys to say, you should believe this witness in my opinion. But here what you're saying is the doctor is allowed to say, you should not believe the defendant in my opinion in the case in chief. It's that vouching part of it and who the witness is that is disturbing.
But I see a distinction between saying, you should not believe him, and saying, this man in the course of my job came in and I conducted an interview, and no discussion of the case is brought up, no facts of the case. And what is your opinion? Yes, he faked answers and he exaggerated. And for that very limited answer that does not go into anything about the facts of the case, I don't think that overshadows all of the testimony of the inmates, all of the testimony of the eyewitnesses so much that you could say that was plain error.
Thank you.
Is that?
You've exceeded your time. Ms. Calloway. So, Ms. Calloway, you would agree that the psychiatrist or psychologist could have come in after your client testified?
No, I would not, because of the way that she obtained the information. She had access to the defendant in this case because of the provisions of the statute at issue, and it provides a very narrow, limited exception to allow a court-appointed examiner to have contact with the defendant, which would not otherwise happen. But if the defendant or any defendant wants to explore a mental capacity defense, they must submit themselves to this examination. And so the only way that the defense team in this case could explore whether or not there was a competency issue or whether he qualified for NGRI was to submit to this examination by this court-appointed expert. And so that's the only way she had the information. And because of that, I don't believe that she should have been allowed to use it even in rebuttal.
Why?
Because the statute limits the way in which the information can be used. It can only be used in rebuttal to rebut a mental capacity defense. The defendant did not advance a mental capacity defense in this case, and so therefore the testimony was improper. If they had advanced a mental capacity defense, then yes, her testimony would have been fair game and she could have testified the way that she did at trial.
What about the fact that the defense counsel had not taken the NGRI off the table?
Obviously, it would have been a better practice if he had done that as soon as he got the report back that the defendant didn't qualify. But if you look at the record in this case, no one was confused about what kind of a defense was going to go forward here. In voir dire, there is no voir dire regarding mental capacity, NGRI, by the prosecutor or the defense attorney. In opening statements, there is no mention of mental capacity defense by either side. When the prosecutor lists the witnesses in voir dire that he's going to call to see if any of the jurors know any of them, he does not list the psychiatrist. He clearly at that point hadn't thought of using her in his case. And then none of the witnesses that are called, none of the cross-examination or questioning suggest any type of a mental capacity defense.
But could have at that point. The defense counsel could have still raised it. I mean, it was still on the table. It hadn't been withdrawn. So they could have brought that up in defense, correct?
It hadn't been withdrawn, but the defense attorneys had not disclosed any witnesses that would suggest that.
But at that point, could the defense counsel have brought it up if they had said, given what we've heard and the case in chief by the state, we're going to bring in NGRI. We are going to claim not guilty by reason of insanity.
It's theoretically possible, but given the rules that require disclosure of witnesses and the fact that none were disclosed, the defendants had no witnesses with which to pursue that defense. But theoretically, I guess if they wanted to put the defendant on to say that he was NGRI, they could have done that.
Counsel, I want to take you back to the statute. What part of the statute are you referring to relating to the rebuttal timing?
Well, Your Honor, the statute indicates that the statements can't be used against the defendant.
What part of the statute? Because Jay says that a prosecutor or defense counsel may call as a witness any person who evaluated the defendant or prepared a report pursuant to this referral. So if you look at Jay, it seems to suggest that on rebuttal, the state could have presented the testimony of this doctor. And you had stated that there was a limitation, and I'm looking for that limitation within the statute.
I think I understand your question. I have two responses. Number one, the statute says that no statements of the defendant may be used against him on the issue of guilt. And in this case, that's what they did. They were not offering this testimony on a mental capacity issue. They were offering on the issue of guilt, and that's not allowed under the statute.
Well, they were offering it for credibility. They weren't offering it for guilt. They weren't talking about any of the specifics of the crime. They weren't talking about statements made by your defendant. There was just actually a conclusory statement made by the psychologist that he was a malingerer.
With all due respect to Your Honor, it was an expert opinion that he is not a truthful person. And what that goes to credibility, but the state is arguing that they wanted to use it for consciousness of guilt, which is guilt. They want to liken it to a case where it's flight evidence and a defendant shows that he's guilty.
Trying to cover his tracks.
Correct. That goes to guilt. Just like in this case, they want to say he was trying to manipulate the system, therefore you can conclude from that he is guilty. The second issue in response to Your Honor's question would be this court's case in Cooey, where the court specifically indicated in very precise language that this type of evidence cannot be used except to counter a mental capacity defense in rebuttal. This court specifically stated that the only way to interpret this statute as constitutional is to limit the testimony of these court examiners to mental capacity evidence in rebuttal. So if you read the statute, the J section, in conjunction with this court's holding in Cooey, it's very clear that the court is concerned about the constitutional implications of allowing this court-appointed examiner to have access to the defendant, and so limits it very narrowly to rebutting.
Therefore, I guess you're answering the earlier question that even if NGRI had been going forward, the doctor still could not testify as to malingering, could she?
If she was going to offer testimony like that, it would have to be specifically to rebut something that was put on by the defense, and it would have to be done in rebuttal. That's not the situation that happened here, and so it would depend on the circumstances of what the defense presented, I think.
Counsel, can we go back to the statutory language that you were referring to? And if we look at the language that was added in 1997, even though we have this no statement that the defendant makes shall be used, then it says, but in a criminal action or proceeding, the prosecutor or defense counsel may call as a witness any person who evaluated the defendant or prepared a report pursuant to a referral. What does that mean then?
That's an excellent question. What I can say is that sentence has to be read in conjunction with the rest of the statute, and that it allows the prosecutor to call the court examiner as a witness to offer to rebut anything that the defendant puts on in a mental capacity defense in rebuttal. It doesn't limit the court-appointed examiner to just providing the report. It just says that the court-appointed examiner can also be a witness in the case for either side. But I don't think that language obviates the other language in the statute, specifically in J and in the rest of the statute, which says no statements can be used on the issue of guilt.
Are you saying that the doctor could never testify whether a defendant was malingering or not, either in the case in chief or on rebuttal?
I'm saying in this particular case, the evidence of malingering in the state's case in chief was inappropriate. Whether or not it could have been offered in rebuttal in this case, I don't believe it could have been in this case. In another case where a defendant offered a mental capacity defense, perhaps it would have been appropriate, depending on what the defense offered. the problem, the serious grave problem that I have with what happened here is that the statute is very specific about what the court-appointed examiner is allowed to inquire into. And it's really only two things, whether the defendant is competent or whether he was qualifies for NGRI. And in this case, when the court-appointed examiner started offering opinions about malingering, she went beyond the scope of what she is authorized
Isn't
to do.
Isn't that saying that he's not qualified for NGRI because in her opinion, he was exaggerating his answers? I mean, that seems totally coherent to me.
She's going beyond the scope of what she was offered to do and opining on the reasons why she doesn't feel that he's qualified, which, again,
You want this expert to be able to say he qualifies yes or he qualifies no, and I can't tell you anything beyond that.
If she wants...
You're not allowed to probe the veracity or the depth of the examination with that expert? Is that what you're telling us?
No, I'm not going that far.
Well, why would an answer that he does not qualify because he's exaggerating answers not be consistent with the opinion expressed as to why he didn't qualify, especially when not guilty was before the court?
The problem with it in this case is the way that the information was used. If they had advanced a mental capacity defense and she wanted to offer her opinion as to yes or no and then offer this justification for her answer in rebuttal, perhaps that would have been appropriate. What I'm saying is in the statute, there is limitations on the way that the information can be used. And so that when you put the defendant, make him subject to this examination without counsel being present, without counsel being on notice of how this information could be used against him, and without advising him that this information might that she might turn into an expert witness for the state, none of that, he was on notice of none of that, that there's serious constitutional problems with the way the state is advocating that this statute be interpreted.
And so if the defendant had called this doctor in the defendant's case in chief, let's say, and for whatever reason asked questions regarding the report and so on, then on rebuttal the state could inquire further or would do it on cross-examination, actually, correct?
Yes.
All right.
It was particularly harmful in this case because the only evidence that the state had on the critical issues of guilt in this case were jailhouse informants. And so they needed this witness, this PhD psychologist,
to bolster
their...
Didn't they have eyewitnesses?
Not to actually what happened. They had witnesses that placed the defendant at the scene, but to actually what
Andrew's
transpired.
Andrew's co-defendant. Ann heard the shot.
Yes.
Okay, so they weren't in the car to see the trigger pulled, but they had some pretty good witnesses at the scene.
Well, Mr. Harris testified essentially that this was a manslaughter or he was shooting in self-defense, and there was no one there to contest that, what actually transpired. There was no
evidence. Well, there has to be some evidence to support that. You can't just say it was shooting in self-defense and there's no physical evidence to suggest that that was the case.
Well, no, the decedent was reaching for a firearm, which was found in the back seat of the car. And what's actually more important is that the decedent was found with all of his money, his car, his gun. And so there was no evidence to support the robbery in this case, which was the aggravating factor for the aggravated murder. And so all they had on that was the testimony of jailhouse informants who testified in a way that contradicted the actual evidence. And so their testimony was inconsistent. The Supreme Court of the United States and most other courts have called into question the use of this type of testimony. And when you put that up against a PhD psychologist, it creates a disparity in terms of the evidence and the bolstering that the state did in order to get where they wanted to go with the conviction.
But what's the difference between this defendant going to the psychologist and making false statements, exaggerations, etc., trying to cover up his guilt, okay? To give him a defense. What's the difference between doing that and going to a friend of his and trying to establish an alibi with that friend, and then the prosecutor bringing in the friend to say, what did Mr. Harris ask you to say on the stand if you were ever questioned about that evening at that particular time? What did he ask you to say? And here, Harris is asking the psychologist to say, I'm not guilty by reason of insanity. This is what I want you to do for me, Doc. And, you know, maybe not in so many words, but certainly by interviewing, raising the issue, and agreeing to the evaluation, examination. So what's the difference here? The friend asked to provide an alibi would certainly be appropriate to bring in to the case in chief, would it not?
It would.
Okay, tell me the difference here. Is it just because this person has a PhD?
No, Your Honor, there are two critical differences. Number one, in your hypothetical with the alibi, the person is recounting statements that the defendant made. In this case, the expert went beyond that and is just offering her opinion. She's offering a medical diagnosis, an opinion that he is malingering, which the defense in this case did not have a chance to counteract because they weren't put on notice that this information was going to be used like this. And in the amicus brief—
Wait a minute. Did they ask for continuance so that they could prepare to cross-examine the doctor once she said their client was a malingerer?
I don't believe so.
Wasn't there a report produced?
Yes.
And in the report, the evaluation that he was a malingerer was part of that report?
Yes.
And they got that report?
Yes.
They were not surprised to hear the doctor say that their client was a malingerer.
Well, that goes to my second point to your question. I think they were extraordinarily surprised that the state was allowed to use this information this way. And the critical problem here is with the way that the psychiatrist got the information. She got it because the defendant was forced to submit to her examination.
Because he brought the idea, he introduced his incompetency and his NGRI. And the statute says the proceeds of that evaluation can be used by either the state or the defense.
Two things to that, Your Honor. It says that statements of the defendant cannot be used against him on the issue of guilt, which is what was done. And this court in Cooey said that these court-appointed examiners cannot testify in the state's case in chief, but can only testify in rebuttal to rebut a mental capacity defense. The problem here is that Mr. Harris denied on the stand that he submitted an issue of competency. That was filed by his attorney. His attorney thought there might be a competency issue, and so he filed it, which triggered Mr. Harris to be submitted to this court-appointed examiner, and then everything that flowed from that. So it's clearly unfair. And
so when he tells his jailhouse companions that he's going to fake being crazy or whatever, that was additional evidence that was before the jury, correct?
Well, if the court looks at the transcript, that's actually not what happened. There's two instances, and I'll refer the court to the page numbers. On page 1061, there's a conversation with Tobias Johnson where they are that's one of the jailhouse informants, where they're speaking about someone else who engaged in this procedure and just saying, do you think that would work? Do you think I should do it? He never says, I'm going to do this or this is my plan. The second instance is on page 1096 with jailhouse informant Antonio Gray, and he just said that he was going to file an NGRI, and if that didn't work, he was going to pursue another defense, which is the obligation of defense teams to explore all of the defenses that might be available to their clients. And so there was nothing nefarious going on here, and the state's suggestion that these inmates all testify that he was planning to do this fake out with the psychiatrist simply does not bear out in the transcripts.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used all your time. You may sum up in 30 seconds.
I guess I had 2 points. You had asked about what do you do with that language that came from the 1997 amendments? I would ask that you look at State v. Mathis, which discussed the same issues we're discussing today. And on talking about what the evidence was also before the jury, there were phone texts showing that this whole drug deal had been set up. And then even in the middle of it, though, when Harris testified, he changed how many drugs he said he was bringing, as opposed to what he originally said he was going to bring, and then he changed it, which also, to me, inferred that there was an intent to rob because he was changing the amount of money they were talking about exchanging hands with. That's all I would say.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marsha, will you call a recess, please?